This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirzad Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَمَا تَكُونُ فِي شَأْنٍ وَمَا تَتْلُو مِنْهُ مِنْ قُرْآنٍ وَمَا تَتْلُو تعملون من عمل إلا كنا عليكم شهودا وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater. But it is in a clear book.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Moscow denies Washington's accusation that its fighter jets caused the crash of a U.S. drone over the Black Sea, calling the incident a provocation. North Korea confirms it test fired two short-range surface-to-surface ballistic missiles on Tuesday, which hit their targets with precision. And thousands of supporters of Senegal's opposition leader start 3 days of planned protests by holding a massive rally in the capital, Dakar. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, Russia's defense ministry says its scrambled fighter jets following the detection of a U.S. drone over the Black Sea, but denied causing it to crash. The source said Russian jets did not use their onboard weapons and did not come into contact with the U.S. drone. It said the drone crashed due to, quote, sharp maneuvering. The United States denies that. The Pentagon says that it was forced to crash its MQ-9 surveillance drone because it was struck by a Russian Su-27 jet. The U.S. Air Force claims the aircraft was conducting routine operations in international airspace. Washington later summoned Russia's ambassador to protest what it called Russia's reckless act. The ambassador said Moscow views the incident as a provocation. North Korea says it has fired two ballistic missiles amid major joint drills conducted by South Korea and the United States. The Korean Central News Agency said two ground-to-ground missiles in a medium-range system were launched on Tuesday. It said the missiles precisely hit the target off the northeastern coast. The latest launch came 3 days after Pyongyang fired two strategic cruise missiles from a submarine. Meanwhile, U.S. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby has said North Korea's missile launches would not affect the joint drills. The 11-day military maneuvers kicked off on Monday. North Korea has conducted several missile tests over the past year in response to the frequent U.S.-led drills around the Korean Peninsula. Pyongyang regards the drills as a rehearsal for invasion. President Xi Jinping has called on the Chinese military to become a great wall of steel to safeguard the country's interests. Addressing the National People's Congress, Xi also highlighted the need for greater stability and security at home. His remarks came amid soaring tensions with the West, particularly the U.S.
China's President Xi Jinping has pledged to bolster the country's security and build the military into a great wall of steel to defend Beijing's interests.
so as to guarantee a new development pattern through a new security architecture. We should further advance our mobilization drive in terms of national defense and military, and to turn China's military into a great wall of steel that will effectively defend the country's sovereignty, security, and development interests.
He also stressed the need for an improved national security system, as well as an improved social governance system.
Security is the foundation for development. Stability is the prerequisite for prosperity. We should implement a holistic approach to national security and improve our national security system, strengthen our capacity for safeguarding national security, and enhance public safety governance, as well as to improve the social governance system.
He also reiterated Beijing's opposition to secessionist activities and external interference in Taiwan. Xi's remarks came in his closing speech to China's parliament, the National People's Congress, where last week he secured unanimous support for an unprecedented third term in office. During his speech, Xi also said China must achieve greater self-resilience and strength in science and technology, a call that comes as the United States blocks China's access to chip-making equipment and other cutting-edge technologies. Meanwhile, China's premier has said some people in the U.S. have been trumpeting decoupling from China in recent years.
I know that in recent years, some in the United States have been trumpeting the idea of decoupling from China, and sometimes it could become quite a hot topic on the media. But I wonder how many people can truly benefit from this kind of hype. According to Chinese statistics, two-way trade between China and the United States last year totaled $760 billion, which again set a new record in history.
Kiang said China and the United States can and must cooperate, and there are a lot that the two countries can achieve by working together. He stressed that encirclement and suppression are in no one's interests. The latest remarks by Xi Jinping regarding China's focus on security comes as relations with the U.S. have hit their lowest point in decades. Chinese officials had previously warned that Washington's efforts to contain Beijing's interests could lead to conflict and confrontation between the two superpowers.
Xi Jinping's remarks on modernizing China's military have sent a strong message to the U.S. Beijing and Washington have been at loggerheads over a number of issues, including the status of Taiwan and the U.S. crackdown on Chinese tech companies. The U.S. has for years pursued a policy of containment of China's development, but why does the U.S. insist on confrontation rather than cooperation?
America's increasingly confrontational posture toward China is a significant shift in the U.S. foreign policy that needs greater scrutiny and debate. For most of the past half century, the United States sought to reshape China through economic and diplomatic engagement. In the case of the Trump administration, through economic and diplomatic disengagement. The Biden administration, by contrast, has shelved the idea that China can be changed in favor of the hope that it can be checked. The White House has moved to limit economic ties with China, to limit China's access to technology with military applications, to pull back from international institutions where the United States has long sought to engage China, and to strengthen ties with China's neighbors. In recent months, the United States has restricted semiconductor exports to China, and this week it moved ahead with plans to help Australia obtain nuclear submarines. The administration also is seeking to impose new restrictions on American investments in certain Chinese companies. In treating China as a growing threat to American interests, it is acting with broad support, including from leading Republicans, much of the military and foreign policy establishments, and a growing portion of the business community. China also is demonstrating a greater willingness to engage in worrying provocations, mounting military displays in the South China Sea and Taiwan Strait. China and the U.S. have locked themselves into a new cycle of recriminations, provoking fresh worries that the world's two biggest economies are heading down a path that could one day lead to the once unthinkable, the possibility of open conflict. The dueling narratives brought into focus how the U.S. and China increasingly have one thing in common, a growing distrust of the other side. Even worse, the escalating rhetoric is entrenching divisions that could make it harder for both sides to find a way to coexist peacefully over the long term.
Notes of our former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan has finally agreed to appear in a lower court that had issued an arrest warrant against him for ignoring summons. In a video message, Khan said he would give a surety bond, that is, to the court in the capital of Islamabad on March 18th. He said authorities have no reason to arrest him anymore. The former premier cited security reasons for not appearing in the court that had been targeted by militants before. Meanwhile, riot police clashed with Khan's supporters who had gathered outside his house to prevent officers from arresting him. Last year, a no-confidence motion in parliament resulted in Khan's ouster. As prime minister, the chief of the Tehrik-e-Insaf party is accused of unlawfully selling state gifts while in office. Khan denies any wrongdoing and says the arrest warrant was politically motivated. In Senegal, thousands of supporters of opposition leader Ousmane Sonko have taken to the streets in the capital, Dakar, as the country prepares for elections in less than a year. The rallies are the first of 3 days of demonstrations. The opposition leader faces charges of libel and rape. Sonko denies the charges. His supporters say the incumbent president, Macky Sall, seeks to weaken the competition through false accusations and political trials. They oppose the widespread speculation that the president will likely run for a third term, which the opposition says is unconstitutional. Sall has neither confirmed nor denied that he plans to run. Syria's President Bashar al-Assad is in Moscow for an official visit. The president was greeted by high-ranking Russian officials upon arrival. The Kremlin said President Vladimir Putin will hold talks with Assad on Wednesday. It said that developing cooperation in politics, trade, and economy will be discussed in the talks. The Kremlin said prospects for the settlement of the circumstances in and around Syria will also be discussed. President Assad was also in Moscow back in September 2021. And prices remain high in the United States despite the Federal Reserve's aggressive campaign to tame inflation. A new report by the U.S. Labor Department says a consumer price index rose 6%. From a year ago in February. Our guest in the News Review program had more on this.
Hello and welcome. It's time for this hour's News Review. Well, a government report shows the U.S. consumer inflation remains elevated, adding pressure to the Federal Reserve as it mulls further rate hikes to cool prices. Now, according to a report by U.S. Labor Department, the consumer price index in February rose 6% from a year ago. Now, that's below January's figure, but the level remains well above policymakers' longer-term 2% goal. U.S. Central Bank has been on an aggressive campaign to tame inflation, raising interest rates 8 times since early last year to ease demand. The bank has vowed to increase the pace of rate hikes if necessary to curb inflation. But the collapse of the two banks may complicate the efforts. The implosion marks the biggest banking failure since the 2008 global financial crisis. I'd like to welcome my guests to this News Review. Out of Washington, D.C., Press TV's Colin Campbell. And out of New York, Daniel Shaw, academic and commentator. Thank you both for being with me. Well, let's start off with Colin. Colin, tell us about the overall situation. This report is coming out in dealing with inflation. This is right after the collapse of these two banks. Just give me an overall feel for what's going on there.
Yeah, you had a bank that was over-leveraged, to put in a short term there in the least amount of words as possible, where you had a number of investments that were going into various projects, venture capitalist interests. And then when it came time to pay on those loans that were that were lent out, the bank realized that it wasn't totally solvent when it came to those issues. So it definitely put a run on the responsibilities that the bank was supposed to pay out. And then those who were already invested in the bank, those depositors, weren't necessarily going to get what they wanted on their return. They weren't all able to get their money back if they wanted to. And so, of course, this put the market into spin because of the revelations discovered from this bank. So what the president talked about was making sure that he put in place measures, or at least was at least being diligent about measures being put into place to prevent what's called contagion. And that's other banks that might be in similar situations that might fall into that same precarious position. Of course, this sets up a lot of anxieties for speculators and for the market, as we saw a ripple effect going across the world. And at the same time, the Fed is in a sticky position because they have been trying to regulate the amount of spending and inflation rates. But this could offset some of their predictions or some of their prognostications about how they were going to handle this situation, especially with an elevated consumer price index. People are still feeling the pain, but the Fed wants to see if the spending has slowed down enough where they don't have to tick up rates again, because this could cause further problems in the banking industry.
Well, Daniel, how do you see it? I mean, because we're also looking at the unbelievable prices for consumers compared to last year. I mean, obviously, the situation is putting a lot of pressure on the average American. Is this something just in passing, as U.S. President Biden has said, that everything is under control? Or is this the beginning of a more rapid downhill spiral?
What we're again seeing, similar to the 2008-2009 financial meltdown, we see those that receive the big salaries, the executives of these banks, paying themselves handsomely, big bonuses. They have speculated, taking all types of risks with everyday people's money. And it's kind of like the cliche about there's no atheists in the foxhole. All of these Republican laissez-faire, you know, hands-off, let the market do what it does. But as soon as they run into trouble, who do they go to? They look for another trillion-dollar bailout. So it harkens back to what we experienced in 2009, a bailout not of the U.S. people, but of these massive banks. That's what we're experiencing now with Signature Bank, with Silicon Valley Bank. They have not been responsible. They wanted deregulation. And now when they falter, who do they turn to for regulatory measures that can back up their speculation? So the economy as a whole has bounced back some. Certainly the inflation that we're experiencing right now is not as bad as it was 6 months ago or 8 years ago when it hit the highest rate, about 9.8%, which was roughly what it hit in 1981 under Ronald Reagan. But for an everyday family, gasoline continues to be extremely high. If before we could do our grocery shopping with $250 for a family of three or four, now we have to spend $400 or more dollars on our groceries.
All right. On that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me on this news review. Colin Campbell out of D.C., Peace correspondent, Daniel Shaw, academic and commentator out of New York. And thank you for staying with us for another news review.
That's a wrap for now. We'll be right back.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate, praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the limelight.
After intensive negotiations hosted by China, the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia have reached an agreement to restore diplomatic relations and reopen embassies in each other's capitals. 7 years after ties were severed over several issues. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. Iran and Saudi Arabia have restored ties after 7 years, brokered by China. The deal is almost assuredly bad news for the United States and worse for Israel. The Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi commented on the restoration of ties by saying, "I think this sends very clear signals to the world that the Middle East belongs to the people of the Middle East, and the fate of the region should be in the hands of its peoples." Meanwhile, Ali Shamkhani, the secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, expressed an all-round willingness to continue constructive dialogue, fully implement the consensus, enhanced good neighborliness, and to jointly safeguard regional security. Ali Shamkhani said, "At the end of the talks, we reached a decision to start a new chapter after 7 years of severed relations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia, while consolidating the interests of the two countries. The security and well-being of the region and preventing undue intervention from extra-regional forces, particularly from the West, and constant mischief by the Zionist regime in the region. We hope that this new chapter will compensate for the stagnation of relations over the last 7 years and also lead to stability and security in the region, as well as improvement of welfare of all the peoples of the region." Saudi Arabia was also positive in its assessment of what this deal means. "When it comes to the agreement itself, this is what we know. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and Iran have agreed to restore diplomatic relations, which will be followed up by reopening of embassies and diplomatic missions within a period not exceeding 2 months, according to protocol, resulting in the exchange of ambassadors. The two countries agreed to implement the Bilateral Security Cooperation Agreement signed on 17th of April 2001, as well as the General Agreement reached on 27th of May 1998, aimed at fostering ties in the economic, commercial, investment, technical and scientific fields. Saudi Arabia has also refused to issue entry visas to an Israeli delegation invited to a United Nations-sponsored tourism event in the kingdom, dashing Tel Aviv's hopes of warming relations with Riyadh in the foreseeable future." Since the announcement of the restoration of ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia, there's been a tidal wave of responses and reactions internationally. In the Israeli regime, the opposition has been quick to react and has slammed Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, stating that the restoration of diplomatic ties between Saudi Arabia and Iran represents a failure of foreign policy by Israel's longest-serving Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. There is no doubt, however, that this is seen as a major defeat for the United States and its standing, especially when it comes to diplomacy. "This agreement demonstrates the Saudis don't trust Washington. Iran sees opportunity to peel away US allies to end international isolation. Although this may be a huge diplomatic victory for China, this is also a victory for Iranian foreign policy when it comes to Yemen and Saudi Arabia. Let's not forget, this was a face-saving deal for the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, since his Yemen policy was defeated due to the Ansar Allah movement's dominance in Yemen. Détente between Iran and Saudi Arabia will result in regional stability, which is causing anxiety among Zionists. Saudi Arabia was also defeated in Syria when it backed Daesh terrorists with the help of its allies, such as the United States. Other issues leading to severance of diplomatic ties between Tehran and Riyadh included the Saudi execution of the prominent Shiite cleric Sheikh Namr Baghir al-Namr. Saudi Arabia was also responsible when it led Persian Gulf Arab monarchies to blacklist the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. Nevertheless, this was Hezbollah's reaction to the agreement. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah's leader, reacted to restoration of ties between Tehran and Riyadh by saying, "It is an important development, of course, and if it proceeds in its natural course, so we don't rush things, it's still fresh news. It could open up horizons in the entire region, including in Lebanon." The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia's past behavior shows that it cannot be a trustworthy partner until certain actions are taken when it comes to issues like Yemen, Palestine and Syria, where it has played a destructive role. It remains to be seen whether disagreement between Saudi Arabia and the Islamic Republic of Iran would ensure the security of West Asia region and would translate into a decrease of US presence in this region, leading to its eventual withdrawal. China's Global Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. A landmark agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, mediated by China, to resume diplomatic ties and reopen embassies and diplomatic missions within 2 months, after 7 years of no diplomatic ties between the two, was reached in Beijing on Friday, 10th of March, which experts hailed as a milestone in helping de-escalate tensions and restoring peace in the Middle East, as well as injecting stability into a volatile geopolitical landscape. The role that China plays in helping the two countries, which are long-term rivals, reach the agreement, won widespread praise from around the world after its announcement. This also shows that China's diplomatic philosophy that aims to promote peace and development is much more appealing than some countries' tactics of fueling confrontation to expand their own political domain in the Persian Gulf region. Experts told the Global Times that this is also one of the best practices under the Global Security Initiative, GSI, that China proposed, and it could have a far-reaching implication and demonstrative effect on other regions of the world that face similar problems of confrontation and conflict. The spokesperson for China's foreign ministry said on Saturday that China looks forward to seeing closer communication and dialogue between Saudi Arabia and Iran and stands ready to continue playing a positive and constructive role in facilitating such efforts. Their dialogue and the agreement set a good example of how countries in the region can resolve disputes and differences and achieve good neighbourliness and friendship through dialogue and consultation. This will help regional countries to get rid of external interference and take the future into their own hands. The spokesperson for China's foreign ministry noted that China will continue to contribute its insights and proposals to realizing peace and calm in the Middle East region. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Friday welcomed the deal and praised China, Oman and Iraq for promoting the talks. Countries including Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Iraq, Oman, Lebanon, Bahrain, among many others, also expressed positive sentiments towards the two countries' decision to resume diplomatic ties. The talks to resume diplomatic relations were conducted in Beijing from 6th of March to 10th of March, according to a trilateral statement from China, Saudi Arabia and the Islamic Republic of Iran. China's Xinhua news agency reported both Saudi Arabia and Iran extended their appreciation and thanks to Iraq and Oman for hosting multiple rounds of dialogue between 2021 and 2022, and to Chinese leaders and the Chinese government for hosting, supporting and contributing to the success of these talks. While congratulating the two sides on taking a historical step forward, the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said China supports the two sides in making firm strides as agreed in the deal to work for the common bright future with patience and wisdom. As a reliable friend of the two countries, China will continue to play a constructive role, said Wang Yi, the Chinese foreign minister. Saudi Arabia cut its diplomatic ties with Iran in early 2016 in response to the attacks on Saudi Arabia's diplomatic missions in Iran, after the kingdom executed a prominent Shiite cleric, Sheikh Namr Bagher al-Namr. The Al Jazeera television network has also covered this story and tells us more. Iran and Saudi Arabia have agreed to re-establish diplomatic relations in a China-brokered deal that could have wide-ranging consequences, but building on it, analysts say, will prove the main challenge. The agreement signed in Beijing on Friday 10th of March said the two countries' foreign ministers will meet to discuss diplomatic missions within 2 months, marking the end of a 7-year rift. In Iran, the deal was generally welcomed, with senior officials praising it as a step towards reducing tensions and bolstering regional security. Media outlets mainly focused on how the deal signaled a defeat for the United States and for Israel. The rapprochement on Friday, 10th of March, was greeted with optimism by Iraq and Oman, who had previously helped mediate the talks, and many others in the region, while it was cautiously welcomed by the United States. China, of course, was the big victor of the agreement, as it bolstered the legitimacy of its reach across the region. Effectively, not only China became guarantor of this agreement, it also showed that the United States can no longer ignore China's role in the security arrangements of the Persian Gulf region, a region where energy reserves and passageways are more important to the Chinese economy than the United States.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Return of Nazi. Part 1.
Vorleben was a public figure, a functionary of the neo-Nazi NPD party, a right-wing activist, and a supporter of terrorists.
In July 2019, the Italian police discovered a huge stash of illegal weapons, a storage house which belonged to neo-Nazi groups, and every kind of weaponry could be found in it, even a French-made air-to-air missile which was sold to Qatar the previous year. It was unclear how this extremist group had come into possession of it. If this news was reported alongside a number of other news items, it might have had a different meaning. For example, alongside news of the vicious killings in Norway by someone who gave a Nazi salute. Or alongside news of violence against migrants in different European countries, or alongside images of politicians who insult the holy book of some of the citizens of their country.
Every Muslim is a terrorist. Period.
Right now.
Shut your mouth. Sorry. I don't want to hear your mouth.
Oh, please.
Alongside gatherings, protests, riots, political scuffles, and big and small social crises.
In it, far-right activists violently clash with an anti-fascist group.
At least today, Europe does not look very well when it comes to media reports. Thousands of members of Pegida, who consider themselves opponents of the Islamization of the West, gathered in the city center of the German city of Dresden on Sunday. In a Europe which had reached unity with the establishment of the European Union, the erasing of borders, and the introduction of a single currency, today, whispers of nationalism are being heard louder, and some of these parties in some countries have been able to come to power, be it in the parliament or as prime minister or president. Basically, political movements take advantage of the fear of the people. Fear of war caused the formation of the European Union, and now that years have passed since the war and the new generation does not fear war among European countries, for example, war between Germany and France or war between the UK and Belgium, now political movements have been established which have created new fears for the people. When the famous Rudolf Hess was being convicted in the Nuremberg trials, he said he didn't regret anything. Now, his words have turned into the main slogan of Europe's radical right. They shout that they do not regret anything. But why? Of what? This is what I was after during this trip. Extremists have once again risen from the ashes of Berlin. But this time with a different look and color.
The ultras are the most extreme supporters. They've been around for years and are well known for their racist and neo-fascist gestures. They are proud to use the fascist salute in honor of Mussolini.
To my mind, there are many overlapping ideas also between our new right-wing parties and the traditional fascism.
It's always dangerous to compare because history doesn't repeat itself. But it's true that we have now what has been called the third wave of radical rights in Europe. It started at the end of the 80s.
They tend to be anti-Semitism tends to be strong among them. And we don't see much of that in among the radical right parties like the Danish People's Party.
I think Americans supporting somehow right-wing populism tries to impose civil war in Europe, to return to the nationalism, to something like was the situation in the Second World War or First World War, in order to put Europe in turmoil and destroy it completely. To be torn apart by nationalisms.
The position of the far-right extremists is that the EU is a corrupt and bureaucratic union, something that has caused their countries to lose their borders, and their culture and identity are being attacked by illegal migrants. And that's why they expect that referendums are held as soon as possible and their countries exit the EU.
Our proposition, Eurasian proposition, multipolar proposition is quite different. Not to destroy Europe, but construct the Europe on the basis of traditional civilization, on the European values, limiting mass migration and returning to the Christian or Roman, Greek-Roman identity, but not to the bourgeois capitalist nationalism that will finish Europe.
Once someone told me that two things create today's Europe: shame of the events that happened and fear of the things that might happen. All the concepts that represent the EU, a common currency, a borderless continent, or extensive policies of accepting migrants, is this, the meeting of shame and fear.
like freedom, human rights, democracy, social responsibility, tolerance, and peace. They are all a high wall in front of past nightmares, the dream of a world which is nothing like the mid-20th century.
Polling Institute says anti-Semitism is much more prevalent in the AfD than in other parties.
Marcus Fuchs, the longtime spokesman of the AfD party, a group with positions and activities which have become extremely controversial, even in Germany. He's known as one of the most famous extremist right-wing personalities, even if he does not accept this himself. When Marcus was talking about his opinions, I did not feel they were irrational or scary. Who knows, maybe if I were a European citizen too, the things he said would be very exciting to me. Now I can understand why right-wing extremists are slowly taking over everywhere. The media, speaking halls, streets, and even parliaments.
If we try to understand the causes of the development of these far rights in Europe, there are many, but you can see two big categories. The first series is structural, long-term causes. It's a reaction to modernization, or more specifically what we call now, since the 90s, globalization. These rights have taken as their main platform the refusal of globalization, refusing the European integration, refusing the opening of borders. The second cause, and it's linked to it, is the delegitimization of the political class, of the mainstream parties, because there's the feeling that they're incapable of defending the country against globalization, which is seen as a cultural, economic, and political threat.
Far-right parties that now are gaining electoral support in Europe, they are kind of washing out these ideas with, they're cloaking it in another language. So one can say the language gets more and more narrative, more and more radical, the more you get into the underground, the other things are outspoken.
Because these rights, which had been delegitimized during World War II, wanted to reintegrate the parliamentary game. And for that, the only way to do it was to detach themselves completely from fascism and Nazism. And very quickly, they were called no more fascist rights, the right like the party of Jean-Marie Le Pen, created in 1972.
At the beginning, it was a level of the public attention, the level of the public debate that condemned this sort of public expressions. And then, with the time, slowly and slowly, the level of criticism, the level of taboo, the level of public alarm on this kind of statements. And now it's... It's impressive how it's possible for a public, for example, a minister or a political leader, the chief of a political party, to publicly express.
There is an overrepresentation, but we should not exaggerate the extent to which higher educated and higher class voters would go to the more mainstream and lower educated people go to the radical right. Across the board, still the majority of workers and lower educated people vote for mainstream parties. So we should not exaggerate that.
That have succeeded electorally are those who are the most far away from the model of fascism and Nazism, the old right, like the neo-Nazi small movements in Germany or the neo-fascist small movements in Italy, they don't take off electorally. And more recently, there's what you can call a fourth wave of far rights that have really no more connection with the past.
And these people who are beginning to find faith that the old beliefs about extremist rights are wrong are into taking action. For the first time after the Second World War, they sent representatives of a radical right party to the German parliament. Today, with younger and more charismatic leaders coming to power, the rights are slowly taking over the parliaments of different countries. What does the extremist right exactly want? Or let's put it this way, what exactly doesn't the extremist right want? The story is very simple. For the extremist right, national identity is very important, and they oppose anything which wants to weaken or deteriorate it. Now, that could be the arrival of migrants who they think are unlike and different from their society or being part of a union that, according to them, puts them at the same level as other countries and brings their national sovereignty under question.
National communities are exclusive, and that we have this very strong idea of nativism combined with racism and xenophobia, and also ideas about the strong state, that it is the state that takes care of its citizens, and that the citizens are citizens of that state because of their nationality, something they are born with.
Many citizens feel that there are too many migrants and that Western societies are changing too rapidly as a result of migrants entering the country. And radical right parties tap into these sentiments and these anti-immigration feelings, and that's what drives support for these kind of parties.
Now, Europe's fear and historical shame are gone, and this can bring the EU to its collapse. Tumult is on the rise on a daily basis in Europe. TV stations, platforms, the streets, everywhere is the scene of battle between the extremist right and their opposition. But today, we might be experiencing the foreshocks of a huge earthquake. This is where people might want to be the flag bearers of forces that want to return to the highest levels of power after years. Or at least, that's what many think. During the days I was wandering around in European cities and speaking with different experts, at times I would ask myself a question. As an Iranian, why would the re-emergence of the extremist right in Europe matter to me? Then I'd always come to a series of clear answers. I'd remember that in the past decade, a huge wave of people left the Middle East to reach Europe, including some of my own countrymen. I'd remember that extremist right-wing groups are against accepting migrants. I'd remember how entangled the policies of the European Union are with the destiny of my country, and that the right doesn't have the appetite to remain in the EU, and this itself can change a lot of things between Iran and Europe. I remembered that some of Europe's right-wing parties had strong relations with some of the most infamous terrorists in our country's history.
Populism, left populism or right populism in all European countries, now with populist left government in Spain, and growth of right populism of Vox there in Spain, and we have in all the country with Salvini in Italia, Salvini Fratelli d'Italia in Italia, AfD Alternative für Deutschland in Germany with Marine Le Pen. We see the European Union, it has already collapsed. So nobody could heal that. So there is no more, formally speaking, European Union.
During the 2 days that it took to make this documentary, these predictions came true. Today, Vox has 50 members in Spain's parliament and 3 in the European Parliament.
When it comes to explain the current situation, there are different theories around. One theory is it is fascism that is on the rise. Others argue it is nationalism.
Russia, please, if you can, get us Hillary Clinton's emails.
In a world where Trump is its most famous politician, dereliction of duty and trying to win over the most benefits are not strange. Just like fundamentalists in Islamic countries have a violent and illogical take on Islam, extremist rights are in favor of a fearsome proposal on modern capitalism. This 21st century proposal, even though different in each country, has commonalities as well. Extremist rights insist on their national identity. They do not want the European Union. They dislike migrants and letting them in. And they have serious positions against any group that challenges liberal traditions or creates disarray in the capitalism order. My trip to Europe didn't end with an answer. Instead, it made my questions more obvious. We are in the initial decades of the 21st century, and many believe that Europe is on the verge of returning to the situation of the first decades of the 20th century. If you don't forget that all world wars began from this beautiful continent, could these big and small weapon warehouses that pop up across Europe every once in a while, or these sudden killings which every once in a while shock the entire world, be a run-up to a huge nightmare? Is tomorrow the era of Europe's Trumps? These are questions that the green and beautiful continent of Europe has to answer, and we are all waiting for these answers. In a city which is the symbol of Europe, the symbol of France, we can see that there are a lot of tourists. But until when will this situation continue? Until when can tourists easily come here with a Schengen visa and see 20-plus European countries? And until when will all these migrants of African and Middle Eastern descent come and live and work here? And will the French vote for change, or will the current situation and unity in Europe remain? It was the end of the discussion, and before saying goodbye, Marcus was showing me his office. Then I saw something strange. I saw a photo of Marx, the biggest leftist theorist in the office of the most famous radical right-wing party.
This is a famous local poet, yeah? And his poetry was in the local dialect. So he's very famous in Frankfurt for one sentence. Es will man nicht in der Kopenhai, wie kann ein Mensch nicht von Frankfurt sei? So it means I can't understand how can one not be born in Frankfurt.
But it seemed like they had made a mistake. Well, everyone in this world has his own manifest.
The Limelight.
In the United States, a second bank, the Signature Bank of New York, has been shuttered as authorities move to protect depositors. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. All clients of Silicon Valley Bank will have access to their funds from Monday, at no cost to US taxpayers, federal regulators announced as a second bank was shuttered. The Secretary of the Treasury, Janet Yellen, Federal Reserve Board Chairman, Jerome Powell, and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's Chairman, Martin Gruenberg, released a joint statement on Sunday, 12th of March, outlining what they say are decisive actions to protect the US economy and strengthen public confidence in the banking system. After receiving a recommendation from the boards of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the Federal Reserve and consulting with the president, U.S. Secretary Janet Yellen approved actions enabling the FDIC to complete its resolution of Silicon Valley Bank, Santa Clara, California, in a manner that fully protects all depositors, the statement says. Depositors will have access to all of their money starting Monday, 13th of March. No losses associated with the resolution of Silicon Valley Bank will be borne by the taxpayer. A similar systemic risk exception has also been put in place for Signature Bank of New York, which was shut down on Saturday by the state chartering authority. All depositors of this institution will be made whole. As with the resolution of the Silicon Valley Bank, no losses will be borne by the taxpayer. Shareholders and certain unsecured debt holders will not be protected. Senior management has also been removed. Any losses to the Deposit Insurance Fund to support uninsured depositors will be recovered by a special assessment on banks, as required by law. The Federal Reserve Board also said it will make additional funding available to eligible depository institutions to help a